Welcome to the East County Magazine Live Radio Show, the voice of East County, bringing you the hottest news and coolest events from the communities of San Diego's East County. We're your community radio, representing the public interest, not special interests. Broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso with your host, Miriam Raftery.
This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, recording at our studio in El Cajon. Today we open our show with some breaking national news on a suspect arrested on suspicion of sending pipe bombs to prominent Democrats, including two former presidents, as well as to CNN and others. We'll have a profile on the suspect, who had attended Trump rallies and had a criminal history. We'll also have a message for the president signed by over 200 members of the media. In local news, hear why most schools in a local district won't be used as a polling place, as school safety concerns conflict with easy access for voters. From Public News Service, we'll have details on a victory for some immigrants with special protected status. Now, if you missed the deadline to register to vote, stay tuned to hear how you can vote provisionally in the upcoming election in San Diego County, but plan plenty of time, since you'll have to go to the Registrar of Voters if you want to register and vote on the same day. Our newsmaker interview today is with Chardet Fontenot. She's a candidate running on a slate that seeks to reform the La Mesa Spring Valley School District Board and bring respect to all students in the district. Plus, hear about some deceptive tactics being waged by an opposing slate of conservatives. Now, if you bought a lottery ticket in Del Cerro, be sure to check your numbers, since it could be worth over $500,000. A coyote rescued in Ramona this week wasn't so wily. Hear how it wound up upside down and how a helpful citizen assisted in rescuing the not-so-cagey canine, along with animal services. Later on our show, we'll be airing our annual Halloween special with some ghost stories from East County. And then on Destination East County, hear about Halloween happenings coming up, as well as a preview of some other upcoming events, including the annual Mother Goose Parade and more. Plus, hear about some local Boy Scouts who need public help to replace two trailers and the contents stolen from El Cajon. So stay tuned for today's edition of the East County Magazine Radio Show, where East County matters. This is East County Magazine's Capitol Report, bringing you the latest news and newsmakers from our nation's capital. The FBI has announced the arrest of Cesar Savak, a 56-year-old Florida man suspected of sending at least 14 pipe bombs that targeted former Presidents Barack Obama and Bill Clinton, as well as other prominent Democrats, a CNN commentator, and critics of President Donald Trump. Savak, a Republican, attended rallies held by Trump at which Trump vilified Democrats and the media. Rally images show him wearing a red Make America Great hat. Savak has a criminal record that includes making a prior bomb threat in 2002, as well as theft and sale of illegal steroids. Kicked out by his parents, he was living in his van, which was plastered with pro-Trump, anti-liberal stickers and messages critical of CNN at the time of his arrest. His social media accounts include posts vilifying Democrats, including those who were targeted with the bombs. His troubled past includes a bankruptcy and foreclosure, as well as failed businesses. FBI Director Christopher Wray, in a press conference on Friday, revealed how an FBI lab analysis uncovered a fingerprint from an envelope containing an IED, improvised explosive device, that had been sent to Congresswoman Maxine Waters. The fingerprint was confirmed to be that of Cesar Savak. Wray said there is also a possible DNA connection between samples collected from pieces of two different IEDs mailed in separate envelopes and a sample previously collected from Savak in connection with an earlier arrest in Florida. Others targeted with explosive packages include former Vice President Joe Biden, billionaire liberal activist Tom Steyer, who has called for impeachment of Trump, liberal funder George Soros, former Attorney General Eric Holder, and actor Robert De Niro, a prominent Trump critic. Wray warned that other packages could still be in transit. Trump has denounced the bombings, but has repeatedly vilified Democrats, media, and critics, leading to criticism that Trump's inflammatory rhetoric incited the bomber to violence. He has continued to denounce media and political critics even after the bombs were sent to many of those same targets. On Thursday, over 200 journalists condemned Trump's sustained pattern of attacks. They described his behavior as un-American and utterly unlawful and unseemly for the President of the United States and leader of the free world, And the letter adds, Trump's condoning of political violence is part of a sustained attack on a free press, which includes labeling any reportage he doesn't like as fake news. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
At the request of the La Mesa Spring Valley School District, San Diego County's Registrar of Voters has slashed the number of district schools used as polling places from 14 in the June primary to just 5 in the November general election. Our show's producer discovered that a polling place at Murdoch Elementary School near her Mount Helix home has been moved to Spring Valley Academy a mile away, so she mailed the district to ask why. She noted that the new location is not easily accessible for elderly neighbors or others who don't drive, since this would require walking a mile down a steep, busy street with no sidewalks. Superintendent David Feliciano responded that California Elections Code does not allow schools to refuse to have polling places on campuses, but a district can ask the Registrar of Voters to use other locations. Feliciano said in his email, "The district makes this request every year because parents and staff alike have expressed security concerns over members of the public entering elementary school campuses while children are present. Eliminating schools as polling places, however, could have the effect of suppressing voter turnout. Schools are convenient voting locations for parents and teachers, as well as for nearby residents in neighborhoods." Sharda Fontenot, a candidate running for the La Mesa Spring Valley School Board, voiced concern over the changes. "I do believe schools should be allowed to be polling locations," she told East County Magazine. "I know it's very convenient for parents to vote when they drop off or pick up their children. Perhaps, if safety is a concern for parents, community, or the district itself, we may want to discuss having volunteer sheriffs or something similar nearby or on the school premises," she added. Fontenot also questioned whether the school board had been consulted or voted on the decision to ask the registrar to eliminate schools as polls. "We've emailed Feliciano to find out, and also asked for copies of correspondence from any parents who voiced security concerns over polls at schools, and we'll report back once we learn how many actually asked for schooling places to be shut down." Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fistier.
A small but important victory this week for people with temporary protected status who are fighting to stay in this country after the federal government announced it will comply with a court order halting deportations until the lawsuit is done. The Trump administration terminated the TPS program earlier this year, a move that threatened to force more than 300,000 people to return to their home countries. Many TPS holders were granted the legal right to live and work in the U.S. decades ago and now have homes and hundreds of thousands of American-born children. Sandra Granados, a TPS holder from El Salvador, spent 6 weeks on a bus tour called The Journey for Justice to raise awareness of what she calls a cruel program.
"We are fighting to stay with our families. This is a humanitarian crisis already. We are here to make this country better."
Homeland Security Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen has said TPS was meant to be temporary, so the government has the legal right to end it. The feds have now pledged not to try to deport TPS holders while the lawsuit proceeds, plus 6 months should the deportation order be ruled constitutional. Emmy McLean, an attorney with the National Day Laborer Organizing Network and the ACLU of Southern California, represents the TPS holders who are the plaintiffs in the case. She warns that the government has appealed and remains determined to end the TPS program.
"There's no humanitarian impulse. The administration has not come to terms with the tremendous harm of their racism, recklessness, and illegality. This administration was ordered by the court to temporarily halt the terminations, and this is temporary relief only."
The case in question only covers TPS holders from El Salvador, Haiti, Nicaragua, and Sudan. However, the program covers people from 10 different countries. Supporters are pushing Congress to pass a bill that gives permanent residency to all TPS holders. For Public News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter.
If you missed Monday's deadline to register to vote in the November 6th general election, you can still cast a ballot. Here's how. State law allows voters to register during the last 2 weeks before the election and vote on that same day, but you cannot do so at a polling place. San Diego County residents who want to take advantage of the conditional voter registration law must visit Registrar of Voters' office in Kearny Mesa. Conditional voter registration is available only during the 14 days before the election and on Election Day. Prospective voters will be able to register to vote, mark, and cast their ballot provisionally on site. The votes will be counted after election officials verify the voter registration and confirm that the voter has not voted anywhere else in the election. The Registrar of Voters' office is located at 5600 Overland Avenue in San Diego. The office is open from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday until Election Day, as well as on Saturday and Sunday, November 3rd and 4th. On Election Day, the voting hours will be extended from 7 a.m. to 8 p.m. Registrar of Voters Michael Vu advises, don't delay, but also come prepared. This November's ballot consists of two cards. Complete your sample ballot ahead of time, so when you go inside the voting booth, you can quickly fill in your official ballot. To learn more about voting in the November 6th election, you can call 858-565-5800 or visit sdvote.com, sdvote.com. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fistier.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.
Now, straight from the headlines, bringing you our latest top newsmakers. This is Miriam Raftery with the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, 89.1 FM, Descanso, recording at our studio in East County. My special guest today is Evelyn Andrade Himesfield. She's running for the Santee City Council in District 1 against incumbent Councilman Rob McNellis. She's a software engineer and a business owner who previously worked as a program manager at UC Berkeley's School of Public Health and as chair of the Staff Advisory Council. Evelyn, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Why did you decide to run for this office?
I'm running for Santee City Council because I've spoken to many residents in our city, and they feel that the current city council is not listening to their voices. And I want to put the needs of the people of District 1 first, do what's best for our city and quality of life. I want to prioritize the needs of our residents when decisions are being made.
You have said that you want to protect Santee from overdevelopment and increase traffic congestion, two of the biggest issues that are on the minds of Santee voters. How would you accomplish that, Evelyn? And also balance those demands for more housing, especially affordable, against environmental protection concerns and traffic issues.
I think it's important that we get development that our infrastructure can support, development that's not going to add to the traffic gridlock, development that we can protect from fire dangers. We need to prioritize alleviating traffic. Building 3,000 homes on Finita Ranch will not do that. So I'm opposed to that project. I do think we need housing that's close to public transportation, that's walkable to commercial areas, that can help reduce fiscal and environmental impacts. We also need to establish community choice energy. That would bring additional revenue to our city, and at the same time would provide many efficient and cost-saving conversions. It might be the only feasible way for us to meet our state-mandated emission reduction goals.
What are your views on the 3,000-unit Finita Ranch housing development that's in the works?
I stand with the people of Santee opposed to that project. It's just too much, too fast, too soon. Our city does not have the infrastructure to support a large project like that with only two pathways in. It's a fire risk, not only for future residents if it were to be built, but for our current residents if we ever needed to evacuate.
Now, it should be noted that the Santee General Plan Protection Initiative that the people have collected enough signatures for would require the council to give the people a vote before waiving the general plan in the future for projects such as Finita Ranch. But this council, including your opponent, Rob McNellis, voted not to put that on the ballot right away, but rather to study it so it wouldn't be on the ballot until 2020. What is your position on the Santee General Plan Protection Initiative and on that action by the council?
I support the initiative. I have spoken in favor of the initiative at city council meetings. I think it's appalling that they voted to waste $40,000 of taxpayer money when our city is facing deficits to delay the initiative. I think it was a ploy so that way that they would have a possible opportunity to be able to vote on Finita Ranch.
So basically, the only way people can make sure that something like Finita Ranch won't get built at this point would be to replace some of the council people who have delayed this initiative and put people on who have committed to oppose Finita Ranch?
Correct. We have a chance this election to send a message to city council that if they're not going to listen to our voices and represent the needs of the people of Santee first above developers, then we will vote them out and we will elect people on council that are actually going to represent the voices of the people.
Another issue facing Santee is that it's going into a deficit next year if things don't turn around, a budget deficit. How would you strengthen Santee's economy and either find new revenue sources or cut expenses, Evelyn?
So I think it's important that we raise revenue. I do not want to cut services. I do not want to raise taxes, but we do need money. We do need to raise revenue. So one of the ideas I have proposed is a community-owned municipal fiber district in our city. It would bring high-speed gigabyte internet to our residents at low cost with the prospect of bringing high-wage jobs and competition for Cox and AT&T. This would generate millions of dollars in revenue by using infrastructure that some of it, which is already built in our city. I also want to bring community choice energy, as I said about earlier. That would bring much needed revenue that we could use to meet our state mandated emission goals. I am also an advocate for small businesses. I want to help more open in Santee. I've spoken to many small business owners in our city who feel that the permitting process is too long, who feel that larger businesses, corporate business, are prioritized over them. And I think it's time to change that. I think it's time to prioritize the needs of our small business owners and support them here. I support the movie theater project. I support a theater coming to our city. I think those are great ways to increase more tax revenue for our city.
Very good. And can you tell us who your major financial supporters are and contrast that to your opponent, Councilman McNellis?
Yes. So most of my contributors are Santee residents. I have a large support, grassroots support from the city. Outside of that, my support has come from family and friends that live around the country. But most of the money that I have raised has come from Santee local residents here with no ties to development. My opponent, majority of his money has come from developers, has come from construction, has come from the real estate businesses. You know, he says those are his friends and things like that, or that's what his supporters say.
He's a mortgage broker by profession, we should mention.
Yes, yes. So those are his friends. But to me, it matters who your friends are, and it matters that I think that makes a big difference as to what the decisions you're going to be making. And I have made sure not to accept any developer dollars. In fact, I've returned supporters' money just because it could give the impression that I'm taking money from development. I want to owe no debts to anybody but the residents of our city.
Who are your most important endorsements from?
My most important endorsement is from current council member Stephen Houlihan. He is the one council member who I believe stands for the people, votes on their behalf, listens to their voices, and actually cares about our quality of life and cares about saving our city.
Councilman Houlihan was known for leading the successful Stop the Santee Power Plant initiative before he was elected to the council, and he's been very strong on the environmental protection issues as well. Evelyn, where can people get more information about you and your candidacy?
Yeah, so I encourage people to please check out my website, electevelyn.com. There they can find where I stand on many, many issues. They can see more about my background and where I'm coming from, as well as the experience that I bring to the position. And you can also check out my Facebook page at Elect Evelyn Andrade Himesfield for City Council.
And we should know that Evelyn is spelled E-V-L-Y-N, and you can also find additional information about her and all of the candidates in this race in our politics section and our Santee section on eastcountymagazine.org. We have invited all of the candidates onto the show. Evelyn was the first to say yes, and I'm pleased to say that at least five of the other six candidates running for the three seats on the Santee City Council have agreed to come on. We'll be hearing from them in the next few days. Evelyn, I'm going to let you have a last word. Is there anything else you'd like our listeners to know about you or your candidacy?
Yes, I am a new resident to Santee, but that does not mean that I do not care about our city. I care about its future. To me, it's a priority that we save our quality of life and don't overdevelop every single bit of piece of land that we have in our city. I have spoken to thousands of residents and continue to do so every single day because I want to be a voice for you. And so I hope that this election, you will elect someone who actually wants to represent the average citizen, not developers, not construction, not the real estate industry, but your average everyday citizen who struggles with a long commute to work every day, who struggles to pay their SDG&E bills, and who wants somebody who's going to fight on their behalf against big corporations, against developers in our city. That will be me. So please elect Evelyn Andrade Himesfield for Santee City Council District 1.
Very good. I want to thank you very much for joining us today on the East County Magazine Show on KNSJ, the Network for Social Justice.
If you bought a Mega Millions ticket at a Chevron station on Del Cerro Boulevard in San Diego's Del Cerro community, be sure to check your numbers. A ticket worth $562,472 was sold there, state lottery officials confirm. The ticket has five of the six winning numbers drawn on Tuesday, 5, 28, 62, 65, 70, with Mega Ball number 5. Several more tickets sold in other California cities outside of San Diego County also had five winning numbers, each worth over $500,000. A ticket sold in South Carolina had all six matching numbers and is worth nearly $1.6 billion, the biggest Mega Millions prize ever drawn. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is John Fistier.
A coyote rescued in Ramona this week wasn't so wily. County Animal Services responded to a call reporting the coyote hanging upside down from a fence after attempting to jump over and getting a leg caught. There's no word on whether any roadrunner was spotted nearby or if any Acme products were involved. A caller reported the animal's predicament, and an animal control officer restrained the coyote while the helpful caller cut the fence wire, freeing the coyote's foot. The animal was taken to the Fund for Animals facility in Ramona, where a veterinarian treated it for a wounded leg and paw. After treatment and recovery, the facility hopes to release the coyote back into the wild. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is Miriam Raftery.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, in the heart of San Diego's East County.
We have a special treat for you today for Halloween, some local East County ghost stories. East County has many reportedly haunted places. There are many stories of ghost soldiers haunting the former Army barracks in Campo, the final home of the famed Buffalo Soldiers Cavalry Brigade. The old Julian Hotel's original proprietor from the 1800s reportedly haunts the establishment, startling guests in his former room who have claimed he's even tried to climb into bed with them. Out at the old Vallecito stagecoach station, the ghost of a bride, who never made it to the altar and died along the trail, reportedly roams the premises searching for her lost love, clad in the wedding gown in which she was buried. And out along Lakeside's Wildcat Canyon Road, if you see a woman beckoning to you to follow her off the road, don't go. Witnesses have claimed she turns toward her victims to reveal no face at all, a dark specter intent on luring motorists off an embankment to their deaths on a roadway where many people have died. But the most spirited area in our region is the Anza Borrego Desert, according to many detailed stories of ghosts that reportedly haunt those lonely trails, mountains, and washes in that harsh, forbidding terrain. Storyteller Cactus Jim has written, "Many travelers, prospectors, and adventurers have gone into the desert never to return or be seen again. Others have returned with gold nuggets and treasures so rare that we could only dream of being so lucky ourselves. Desert lore, stories, and quests for loot and gold have made men greedy. Gunfights, murders, and death from starvation have left many dead on the barren desert trails. Their ghosts still walk the mountain ridges, gullies, and deserted locations they once traveled or lived, spirits with unfinished business who cannot rest. Some guard buried treasures and lost mines, while others battle perpetually until death, forever replaying their last moments of life," Cactus Jim wrote. So here are a few of the most haunting tales in that region, adapted from Desert USA and the Paranormal Blogspot.
In the 1860s, when stagecoaches were the primary means of cross-country travel, a special stage set out from El Paso, headed for San Diego, with a box of coins. The stage that carried the coins had one driver and a guard. When the stage reached Yuma, Arizona, the guard fell ill and the driver continued on without him. That same stage was held up by robbers somewhere in the area where the route meanders into Carrizo Wash in East County's desert region, between the Fish and the Coyote Mountains. The driver was shot during the robbery and the thieves stashed the coins in the south slope of Fish Mountain. The coins remain there to this day, they say, because there were too many soldiers passing by on the trail for the bandits to retrieve their loot. It is said that after the robbery, the dead driver and the stage continued through Carrizo, and after that, the stage disappeared, never to be seen again, at least not in an earthly form. But some witnesses say that the phantom stage still forges its way through the deep sand, pulled by a team of four mules on moonlit nights. The phantom stage is driven by a lone driver hunched over as if asleep. No passengers are seen on the stage when it passes through Carrizo Wash, hesitating only a moment, as if planning to stop where the Carrizo station once stood, though it's now only a pile of mud. The phantom stage continues on past the old station until out of sight. In the morning, you may think twice about whether you actually saw the phantom stage until you find ruts carved from wagon wheels and fresh hoof prints left behind by the ghostly stage that travels on occasion as if to keep the trail alive.
Vallecito is known for its ghost. Its history contains many murders, deaths, robberies, and other wicked tales. One well-known story involves a double murder at Vallecito Station. It all started with a stage holdup in which $65,000 worth of loot was stolen by four men on horseback who robbed the eastbound stage before reached Carrizo Wash en route to Vallecito Station. As the men fled the scene, the driver of the stage fired one shot, killing one of the four men. When he reached the thief he had shot, he found not one, but two dead bodies. The driver concluded that the leader of the band of thieves had shot one of his own men, so he would not have to divide up the loot. The bandit leader and one of the thieves survived the robbery and buried their loot in nearby hills, then rode on to Vallecito Station for a drink and some food. But the two bandits began to argue while having a drink. The leader of the outlaws went outside to check on his horse, promising to continue the discussion when he returned. He did return, entering through the doorway, mounted on his big white horse, and he shot his companion. As the wounded bandit was dying, he drew his gun and fired back at the leader, killing him off the back of his brave white horse. The white stallion, spooked by the gunfire and death of his master, ran off into the hills. It is said that when someone is in the valley, around midnight, near where the bandits buried their loot, the ghost of a white horse will appear from nowhere, galloping through the sand and then disappearing without a trace.
If you find yourself out late in the desert night, somewhere between the Superstition Mountains and the 17 Palms, you may see the apparition of an 8-foot glowing skeleton. A prospector by the name of Charlie Arizona first saw the ghost about 4 miles southeast of Borrego. It was a dark night when Charlie set up for camp. Just as he was settling down for the night, something disturbed his burrows. Hearing the frightened braying, he went to investigate. A shadow loomed large. Suddenly, he saw a large human skeleton with a lantern light shining right through its ribs. The skeleton walked in a crazy fashion, as if looking for something or as if it were lost. Heart pounded, Charlie watched, transfixed as the skeleton disappeared over the ridge. About 2 years later, two prospectors camping in Superstition Mountains caught sight of the flickering light in the distance and wondered what it was, but it quickly disappeared. One of the prospectors thought it looked like a skeleton carrying a lantern, but they figured it was just the fire reflecting off a rock. The two prospectors didn't think much of the incident until a year later, when a traveler came into the Vallecito station with the tail of a skeleton he saw wandering in the desert carrying a light. It wasn't long before the news of the skeleton got around, and two adventurers went out into the desert to search for this legendary skeleton ghost. During their third night in the desert, they encountered the ghastly lit skeleton. One of the men shot at it with a gun, but the skeleton continued on, unfazed by the gunfire. The two men followed the skeleton for 3 miles as it wandered in a strange and intermittent gait, over ridges and through valleys, before they lost track of it. Many believe that the skeleton is the ghost of a prospector who discovered and worked the Phantom Mine, which has been lost for many years. The skeleton is no better off than the rest of us, for he continues to search for the lost Phantom Mine, wandering the dark desert nights looking for his final resting place.
Not far from the Phantom Mine lies another place where skeletons have been seen. During warm summer nights, when the moon is full, ghosts dance at Yaqui Well. The ghosts are said to be the spirits of 3 emigrants who were traveling from Yuma to California. In search of a shorter route through the desert, the emigrants arrived at Yaqui Well, exhausted and near death from lack of food and water. One of the 3 travelers drank from the well as much water as he could hold. He died shortly thereafter. The other 2 men also drank from the well, but survived. While moving their dead companion's body, the other 2 noticed some rock specimens that fell out of his pocket. The 2 men were excited to discover the rocks contained gold, but they did not know where their friend had found the samples. Their excitement about the gold turned into greed and distrust. The 2 men began to struggle until one finally drowned the other in the muddy water of Yaqui Well. An Indian watched these events unfold from a nearby hill. He tried to talk to the man who had survived, but the emigrant was still so excited as he told his story that he entered a state of frenzy and ran off into the desert yelling, "Gold! Gold!" It is only during the hot summer nights of the full moon that the 3 emigrants return to Yaqui Well. One rises out of the muddy waters of the Yaqui Well. One emerges from the brush nearby, and the 3rd arrives in the cool breeze out of the wash. The ghosts join hands and circle Yaqui Well in a dance. Soon after the twirling begins, they disappear, leaving only the good waters of the well and a slight chill in the air.
In the 1800s, many stories began circulating about a ship lying half buried in the sands of the Anza Borrego Desert, and some say its spectral sails unfurl at times on a ghostly voyage, its phantom crew seeking their way back home. After the Civil War, many migrants who passed through the desert on their way to California reported seeing a Spanish galleon with multiple masts and swore this was no mirage. Most claimed that it was loaded with a fortune's worth of exquisite pearls. Many expeditions sought to retrieve these riches, but so far, none have succeeded. As the story goes, in 1610, King Philip III of Spain ordered Alvarez de Cordone to search off Mexico's coast and bring back pearls. Cordone hired 2 other captains, Juan de Iturbe and Pedro de Rosales. He also hired 60 pearl divers and had 3 ships built. In 1612, they set sail to plunder Mexico's west coast of its precious oysters. The ship paused repeatedly in its travels so that pearl divers could jump off and return with oysters they discovered on the ocean floor. Later, they found a village where Native Americans had baskets of pearls just lying about. The Spaniards arranged a trade of their fancy European clothing for the pearls, but instead swindled the Native Americans by giving them only rags and dirty cloths. Outraged, the Indians attacked the ship as it was trying to set sail. Cordone was hit by an arrow, and his ship was forced to turn around. But he ordered the other 2 ships on in the search of more pearls, commanding them to look north in the Gulf of California. As they journeyed up the Gulf, Rosales' ship struck a reef in a terrible storm. Before it sank, the crew transferred the valuable cargo to Iturbe's vessel, which sailed up the Gulf and eventually up the Colorado River and into the Salton Sea, or Lake Cahuilla, as it may have been called long ago. Some stories claim that the ship sailed into the Salton Sea to find the legendary Straits of Anian, an all-water route from the Gulf of California to the Gulf of Mexico. It's been said that the Salton Sea and the Colorado River ran high, filled with water during a flood that swept the ship into the vast inland sea. Some say that an earthquake happened, closing off escape. The captain was horrified to find the outlet to the ocean blocked. Water in the lake was swiftly evaporating. Soon the ship was beached on the California desert, many miles from the sea. The crew grabbed what few supplies they could carry and abandoned ship, trudging westwards toward the water. As the story goes, the survivors were finally picked up. Other versions of the tale involve a pirate ship loaded down with almost 1 million doubloons. Another story states that the ship was from King Solomon's Navy, carrying the 10 lost tribes of Israel to North America. Another variation on this story claims that the Kaweah Indians, knowing the Spanish were coming to take their riches and harm them, ambushed the Spanish party that came ashore. Then the tribe mounted a full attack on the galleon and after a fierce battle annihilated the entire crew. The Kaweahs began looting the ship of food and exotic items, but they could not move nor break into the heavy large iron chests in the hold. Then a storm brewed up, dousing the galleon. The Native Americans were forced to desert the ship, which broke from its anchor, drifted off into the storm, and sunk into the inland sea, taking its precious cargo with it. By the time the lake dried up years later, the ship had been long buried under tons of dirt, sand, and silt. How true could these stories be? Lake Kaweah did exist in the 16th century and had a tribe of Native Americans living nearby. It is possible that a flood occurred connecting the Salton Sea to the Gulf of California. The area between the desert and the Gulf has the potential to be hit with massive flooding, as we know from Hurricane Kathleen in the 1970s, which sent a 10-foot-high wall of water across the desert floor. So yes, it is plausible a ship could have been carried in on the surge and stranded afterwards as water receded. The sheer number of stories told by both Native Americans and frontiersmen through the centuries suggests some truth to these lost ship tales. Expeditions in search of the lost treasure ship began in the 1800s, after travelers heard tales from Native Americans. Some claimed that the ship seen in the desert was haunted and could only be found at certain times of the year. In 1870, several Indians reported seeing the ship west of Dos Palmas. Later that year, the Los Angeles Star published a series of short stories about Charlie Klusker, who claimed to have located the ship and its broken masts. He was organizing expeditions to bring back the missing vessel, which he claimed was filled with crosses. It was reportedly 50 miles from Dos Palmas in a region of boiling mud springs. But there were no further updates, and Mr. Klusker appears to have simply disappeared, much like the elusive ship. In 1878, three German prospectors said they saw the ship around sundown, about 120 miles northwest of Yuma and 40 miles east of Indio. The sighting actually cost one of the prospectors their lives. The two survivors reported seeing an immense ship under full sail floating over the desert, sailing like a cloud into the sunset. The prospector who died went after it in the next morning, but never returned. A rescue party eventually found him dead from a lack of water, and strangely, he was completely nude. In 1905, a prospector named Butcherknife Ike claimed to have discovered a fossil ship buried in the sand dunes of Borrego Springs. And in 1915, a Yuma Indian arrived in one town paying for his merchandise with pearls. When questioned, he claimed to have spent the night in a strangely shaped wooden house that was partially covered by sand. The people he spoke to offered him several hundreds of dollars for the night if he would take them back there in the morning, but he vanished overnight with their money. In 1933, Antonio de Fierro Blanco wrote a book discussing the story of Tiburcio Mancerna, a young mule driver who claimed he came across the lost Spanish galleon way back in 1775. Back then, Tiburcio was a mule driver for explorer Juan Bautista de Anza, who was searching for a land route from Sonora to Alta California. The young mule driver said he went into the hold of the ship and actually saw a treasure trove of pearls, but was never able to relocate the evasive ship. Many treasure hunters have gone after the missing treasure of pearls, but none have brought back evidence of finding it. Perhaps because these are simply tall tales, or perhaps because the shifting sands of the desert at times reveal and at other times obscure the legendary lost ship. According to some storytellers, the ship itself, now bleached white and desiccated by the whipping sands, blown by the desert winds, has become a ghost. If you're out in the desert late some night, you may just see an eerie, otherworldly glow and hear the singing of those long-dead sailors, the skeleton of a ghost ship sailing into the sunset or adrift in the moonlight. Is the mysterious ship laden with the fortune and pearls still out there in the desert? Perhaps sailing spectrally over the sands? Perhaps one day, when the sands blow the right way, we'll be lucky enough to find out.
Now we have one last hair-raising tale to tell, and this one is about the mysterious giant black cats reported to be prowling the wilds of East County. A reader tells us that sightings of huge black cats the size of mountain lions or bigger date back at least to the 1980s, when witnesses described a black cougar near Highway 67 at the eastern end of Poway. Zoology experts claim there is no such thing as a black cougar or mountain lion, though they once said the same thing about black bobcats until one was killed by a car and proof positive was found that these once legendary animals existed. Another possibility is a black leopard, an exotic pet that's escaped. But a more likely explanation for the many sightings here is that there are black jaguars in northern Mexico, big cats that when fully grown can be much larger than mountain lions. An adult male can weigh up to 350 pounds, though females can be about the size of mountain lions and cubs even smaller. Jaguars have golden eyes, squared heads, and very powerful jaws capable of taking down a full-sized crocodile in the wild. Officially, jaguars have been extinct in California for decades. But have they returned? Or perhaps they never really left. Yet another possibility is that jaguars have bred with mountain lions. That, too, is thought to be impossible, scientists say, but they once thought wolves could not breed with coyotes, until DNA testing proved that they did, and frequently. Many of the early sightings in San Diego County of large black wildcats have been made close to the border, some very near a gap in the border fence in Hukumba Hot Springs, where the terrain was too rugged to connect the fence up. Howard Cook, the former head of Hukumba's planning group, told me there have been regular sightings in recent years of a big black cat believed to be a jaguar, and also what appears to be a golden black spotted jaguar at Lake Hukumba. Such a pair could give birth to cubs that could be either black or spotted. He believes the big cats crossed over from Mexico, and the town librarian's son also saw what he described as a black panther crossing Old Highway 80 and Boulevard some years ago, though there's technically no such thing as a black panther either, a term used by ordinary folks to describe any of several big black cats. Gene Garrity told us that he and a friend, both farm boys, were out hunting above Loveland Reservoir south of Alpine back in 1994, when a huge black cat crossed the road in front of them. The tail was very fat and very long, he said. We got out of my jeep, and we were looking at the paw prints in the mud. They were huge, with very huge claw marks. I estimate the cat was close to 200 pounds or more, he said. Assistant Border Patrol Chief Rosario Pete Vasquez told me, I saw one on Mount Laguna maybe 20 years ago. It was daytime, and there was snow on the ground, so you could definitely tell it was all black. That big cat weighed about 100 pounds, he estimated. One winter night in 2011, the reader reported that a resident of Hapatool Valley, south of Alpine, Warren Storm Thunder, claimed he saw a jaguarundi, a black cat from central Mexico that is a little smaller than a mountain lion. Sharon Cremosis, a rancher and a friend of mine, insists she saw a large black wild cat slightly smaller than a mountain lion while driving her golf cart on a ranch she owned in a remote area of Boulevard near the border. A neighbor of hers has also seen black wild cats, she told us, and she's also seen mountain lions and is confident in her description. Ariel Brook, one of our very own writers, who is also a teacher, saw a large black cat running across a roadway in Deerhorn Valley about a year ago. It looked like a black mountain lion and moved like a wild animal, she said, adding it had a long cat-like tail. In 2012, a resident of Aguanga near Warner Springs at the base of Cahuilla Mountain reported she heard her dogs going ballistic and walked outside to see a huge black cat perched on a boulder near her barn, which had a pig, a goat, and horses stabled inside. She said the cat was creeping up the rocks and had glistening circles of gray on its black fur. It was smaller than a mountain lion, and it sounds to us like a black jaguar cub which could have spots faintly visible. On a blog post, she wrote that neighbors saw the same thing. And the Union Tribune published a report in December 2013 of a couple near Miramar Reservoir who claimed to see a large gray-black cat about 4.5 feet long that swiftly vanished into brush on a steep hill above the water. There have been many sightings locally, though none have been documented with photos, perhaps because these mysterious creatures move swiftly and are often spotted at night, Plus, frightened observers may be more concerned with not becoming dinner than with snapping a photo. We first reported on these mysterious black cat sightings back in 2014, and our readers deluged us with their tales. A reader in the Anza area, in the northeast part of our county, says there were several sightings in 2014 in her area as well. A Pine Valley reader said she was putting out food for a small feral cat in her gazebo one night when she was startled to see what looked like a panther with an unusually strong build, a big head and coal black fur that she believes was a jaguar. "I sure froze in my tracks," she told us, adding that she slowly backed up to her door just as the cat dug in its claws into the carpeting on the gazebo she'd been standing on a moment earlier and pulled up the carpet off the cement. On September 1st, that's just last month, Forest Service volunteers Peter and Chris Ruth wrote to warn us that hikers saw a large animal resembling a big black cat in a tree near Cedar Creek Falls in the Julian area, a popular hiking destination. Soon after, two women volunteers hiking the trail to pick up trash heard growling noises three times and promptly exited the area. Were those black jaguars? Or possibly black bears? Another species thought to be extinct here that have since been documented to have returned, though still rare. In 2013, a Border Patrol camera caught proof positive on an infrared camera in Inkapa where a black bear ran across the road. But the big black cat sighting at Cedar Creek Falls becomes more plausible given a second big black cat sighting reported on October 26, just days ago, to our news publication by Cameron Forbes, who says he and his son saw a giant black cat walking past a campground in broad daylight at Pines Anita in the Julian area, the size of a mountain lion or even bigger. These huge black predatory cats have also been seen in Spring Valley. Last year, a retired U.S. Navy chief, Manuel Domingsong, said he heard his chickens making noise and he went out to find a giant black cat inside the coop. It killed a chicken that night, and at 5 a.m. the next morning, he went out to check his coop and found the black cat back inside, and the rest of his chickens were dead. The large cat leaped over a fence right in front of him. 2 months later, a college professor, Dan Moody, told us that his mother, Dee Moody, a retired high school teacher, saw a jet black big cat weighing at least 70 pounds that sauntered across an open field beside her Spring Valley house in broad daylight. She described it as black and shiny, with a tail at least half as long as its body. And then on Christmas Day last year, a retired professor came across two dead coyotes at the end of her cul-de-sac on the eastern side of Dictionary Hill in Spring Valley. Their throats had been slashed, and the bodies were still warm. Only a very large predator, likely a huge cat, could have killed coyotes, which are themselves a predatory species. We do have coyotes across East County, and you may hear their mournful howls at night. But if you're walking out in the dark in East County, and you happen to catch a glimpse of a huge black shadowy cat, or hear the growl of a large animal, remember the sage advice of poet Ogden Nash, who wrote, "When called by a panther, don't anther."
We hope you've enjoyed these haunting tales from East County. We extend our special thanks to the participants in today's special presentation: Miriam Raftery, Leon Thompson, Devario Bell, Tasha Matthews, Liz Alper, and this is Ed Barena. From all of us at East County Magazine and KNSJ Radio, to all of you, our listeners, we wish you a chilling and thrilling Halloween. Happy haunting!
Welcome to Destination East County with your hosts, Valerie Watts
and Jonathan Getz, bringing you the top festivals, events, and attractions across East County
each week.
This week's Destination East County includes pumpkin patches filled with festive fall activities, a haunted amusement park, spooky campovers, safe trick-or-treating options for children, and a haunted train ride.
Plus, we'll have a preview of coming attractions, including a presentation of It's a Wonderful Life by Pickwick Players and Santee, the Mother Goose Parade in downtown El Cajon, and Tony Orlando in concert at Saquon.
So stay tuned for all of these events and many more.
Nawnee's Pumpkin Patch, run by Bergio Feed and Supply on Old Highway 80 and Boulevard, is open Saturdays through Halloween. The patch is open from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. with games from 11 to 2, including a barrel race, mummy wrap, costume contest, and candy prizes. Visitors are encouraged to bring a non-perishable food item for a food drive and receive a discount on any pumpkin purchased.
Now in its 19th year, Oma's Pumpkin Patch at the Van Omering Dairy in Lakeside is open for the season now through October 31st. You can visit Tuesdays through Saturdays from 10 a.m. to 7 p.m. Activities include Cottonseed Mountain for kids to climb and slide down, a playground with swings, covered hay rides around the farm, a hay bale maze, a petting corral, a pedal cart, and tricycle racetrack, kid-powered games, and a pumpkin patch with pumpkins ranging from small sizes to over 100 pounds. Also available for purchase are Indian corn, corn stalks, gourds, hay bales, honey, crafts, souvenirs, and seasonal items. For admission details and directions, visit omaspumpkinpatch.com.
You're invited to come ride the Pumpkin Express aboard vintage rail cars through the San Diego County Mountains as fall descends on Campbell. Walk through a themed display building at the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum, complete with two haunted trains, a pumpkin patch, and a creepy cast of ghosts and ghouls. For details, visit the Pacific Southwest Railway Museum site at psrm.org.
The Haunted Amusement Park, a Halloween scare trail and haunted house, is open now through October 28th on Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays. The trail leads guests through the abandoned grounds of Marshall Scotty's Playland in Flynn Springs, just east of El Cajon. The Ferris wheel, roller coaster, and bumper cars are now the backdrop to this annual Halloween haunt. The hours are 7 p.m. to 11 p.m. on Fridays and Saturdays, and 7 p.m. to 10 p.m. on Sundays. For more information or tickets, you can visit scaretrail.com.
The Backcountry Resource Center in Boulevard, the former Boulevard Fire Station, will offer free trick-or-treating for children and a costume contest for all ages on October 28th from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. Dinner will be available for a small donation provided by Jay's Southern Cafe. There will also be a raffle, snack walk, and kids' games. Prizes will be awarded for most creative and most fun costumes and for judges' choice.
Lake Jennings in Lakeside is hosting Spooky Campoween events the two weekends before Halloween, October 19th through the 21st, and October 26th through the 28th, complete with ghost stories, s'mores, a campsite decorating contest, trick-or-treating, and creepy crafts. On Friday nights, get in the spirit with ghost stories and s'mores at 7 p.m. Then on Saturdays, there will be campsite trick-or-treating from 4 to 5 p.m., followed by a campsite decorating contest with judging at 6 p.m. Prizes include an all-inclusive camping weekend. For more information, visit lakejennings.org.
A wild and ghoulish night under the stars will be held with rescued exotic animals of lions, tigers, and bears in Alpine on Friday night, October 26th through Saturday morning, October 27th. The annual spooky campover at this world-renowned nonprofit animal sanctuary is a family favorite. Enjoy pumpkin carving, s'mores, campfire songs, special animal feedings, and more. A costume contest will be held Saturday morning, followed by a special feeding visit to watch the big cats and bears enjoy their pumpkin treats. Don't forget to bring camping gear, food, a pumpkin to carve, and, of course, your best costume. For tickets and details, you can visit lionstigersandbears.org.
If you're looking for a safer trick-or-treating option for children, Viejas Outlets in Alpine invites you to visit from 5 to 8 p.m. on Halloween night, Wednesday, October 31st, for a treat. The movie Hocus Pocus will also be playing on the big screen at the skating rink at 6 p.m. For directions and details, you can go to viejas.com.
Now for a preview of coming attractions.
The 72nd Annual Mother Goose Parade will roll through the streets of downtown El Cajon on Sunday, November 18th, beginning at 1 p.m. Hundreds of entries come from across the county to share in the excitement. The lineup includes spectacular floats, marching bands and drill units, eloquent equestrians, animated clowns, special characters, performing artists, Hollywood celebrities, giant helium balloons, specialty vehicles, and Santa Claus. Each entry is selected to bring enjoyment to children and adults alike. The parade starts at Main Street and El Cajon Boulevard, proceeding 1.25 miles to its conclusion at 1st and Main Street. Afterwards, celebrity child stars may be found signing autographs at the Downtown Cafe and Urban Pizza. For more information, you can visit mothergooseparade.org.
Pickwick Players in Santee will present It's a Wonderful Life, a live radio play opening November 30th and running through December 15th. The production recounts the classic story of George Bailey's Christmas Eve, when the depressed man is visited by a guardian angel who shows him the lives he has touched, and then shows him how different his community of Bedford Falls would have been without him. On opening night, a champagne reception will also be held. For tickets, you can visit pickwickplayers.net.
Singer Tony Orlando will perform at Saquon's Live and Up Close Theater on November 30th at 8 p.m. The Grammy nominee celebrates 5 decades of endearing entertainment, including 5 hit records, Tie a Yellow Ribbon Round the Old Oak Tree, Knock 3 Times, Candida, My Sweet Gypsy Rose, and He Don't Love You Like I Love You. Tie a Yellow Ribbon was the #1 Billboard song of 1973 and became Orlando's theme song. For tickets, you can visit saquon.com.
That's all for this week. You can find details on all of these events and more in the calendar and events section at our website, eastcountymagazine.org.
If you have an event you'd like added to our calendar, or if you would like to sponsor the Destination East County column on our website, or the Destination East County show on KNSJ Radio, you can contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. Destination East County is the most read feature on our website.
We'll be back next week with more festivals, events, and attractions in San Diego's East County.
See you around East County!
Boy Scout Troop 363 in El Cajon needs help after thefts of 2 trailers containing all of their gear and equipment, including supplies needed to run their annual Christmas tree lot sales in December, a fundraiser that sustains the Scouts' year-round camping program, was stolen. In June, the first trailer was stolen out of the Elks parking lot in El Cajon, despite anti-theft measures. They lost all of their camping supplies, but have continued with privately owned camping equipment. But soon after, the troop's Christmas tree lot trailer was also stolen. The boys learn real-life skills working at the tree lot, such as customer service, sales, building the lot, and caring for the trees. Loss of this fundraiser means many boys will not be able to attend future camping events because their families can't afford it. Troop leaders say there is no way for the 35-year-old Troop 363 to continue helping these scouts on their monthly camping trips without help from the community. Troop leaders hope to raise $10,000 in the next few weeks to buy 2 scout trailers, camping gear, and supplies needed for their tree lot so that they can continue to help young people in East County, as well as provide fresh Christmas trees for the community. You can help by donating at a GoFundMe site for Boy Scout Troop 363. Reporting for East County Magazine on KNSJ, this is former Boy Scout Jonathan Goetz.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso, bringing you public interest news from our region.
This concludes today's edition of the East County Magazine radio show. We extend our appreciation to the Heartland Coalition, our parent nonprofit, and to KNSJ 89.1 FM, broadcasting from the heart of East County in Descanso. We extend our appreciation to our sound technician, Jonathan Goetz, and to our producer, Miriam Raftery. We also thank the musicians who provided music for our show, Laura Preble, Jim Hannibal, Corey Clement, Giovanni Galicia, and the Smashing Beats. Wooden Ambulance, Dusty Summer Road, A.K. Jewel, Brian Boyko, Royalty Free Music, Frank Nora, Kevin McLeod, April's Dance from the Smart Sound Solo Simplicity Collection, Turco, Nomads of the Silk Road, Blues 3 Music, and Pond 5. If you would like to underwrite or sponsor the East County Magazine radio show, or get involved as a volunteer on our public interest news show, please contact editor@eastcountymagazine.org. We'll be back soon with another edition of the East County Magazine radio show.
This is KNSJ 89.1 FM Descanso in the heart of San Diego's East County.